From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Are you innocent of the charges?
Yes, of the charges. Yes, I'm innocent of all the charges they've made against me.
Lori Berenson speaks from prison, a Democracy Now! Exclusive.
I mean, civilian trials in Peru also can last 6 years. In my case, at this point, with such publicity that I've had, such negative publicity that I've had in Peru, I would never get a fair trial.
Though Lori Berenson's life sentence has been voided, the Peruvian regime wants to try her again. Her voice has not been heard in almost 5 years. Today, we break the silence. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The Associated Press is reporting that thousands of armed pro-Indonesian militia members and their supporters stormed the West Timor office of the UN High Commissioner for Refugees. Witnesses say militiamen beat three foreign UN workers to death and burned their bodies in the street. The three were the first civilian UN workers to be killed in Timor. Two peacekeeping soldiers have died in border skirmishes with armed militia infiltrators in UN-supervised East Timor in recent weeks. The UN building was also set on fire by the mob, angered by the unsolved death a day earlier of a prominent militia leader who was accused of committing atrocities in East Timor last year. The nationalities of the murdered victims was not immediately known. Several foreign UN staff had escaped and one was badly injured. A UN force is flying into West Timor from East Timor to evacuate remaining workers. And this sad news from another part of Indonesia. We now have word that Jafar Siddiq Hamzah, a graduate student of New York University, a publisher and human rights lawyer who is a permanent resident in the United States, he is Achenese himself, went to his homeland in Aceh, disappeared a month ago, and it looks like, as we speak, an autopsy is discovering that the body of one of five young men found is Jafar Siddiq Hamzah's. We go to the phone right now to journalist and activist Alan Nairn, who is in Asia and close to the case. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Alan Nairn.
Thanks.
Well, can you tell us what you know at this point?
Well, a couple of hours ago, one of the doctors who was working on the autopsies of the five bodies said to the family that one of them appeared to be Jafar's body. They have not made an official announcement yet. The team of physicians hasn't. They won't do that until tomorrow morning, local time. But the family believe that this is, in fact, Jafar's body.
This body, possibly or probably Jafar Siddiq Hamzah's, was found with four others. Is that right? In what condition?
Yes, there were five bodies found in a very rural area outside of Medan. Medan is the town where Jafar disappeared. The bodies had their hands bound with barbed wire. They had multiple stab wounds. They had been tortured. They were in such bad shape that when Jafar's family yesterday went to look at them, they couldn't tell anything from just looking, because these bodies were so badly mauled and decomposed. It's only now, after the autopsy looked into inside Jafar's body, where there were several distinguishing scars left by operations he had, it's only then that he could be identified.
What is happening in Aceh that these five bodies have turned up, one of them most likely Jafar's?
Well, many people disappear in Aceh. It has increased recently. The Indonesian armed forces and police are waging a campaign of what the police chief in Aceh himself openly described as repression. They often make statements about catching people dead or alive. And this is the terror that Achenese have been living with. And in In the case of Jafar, he was walking on the streets of Medan. He had received threats. He was calling into his home every 2 hours because he feared something might happen, and he disappeared without a trace until now. It appears to be a very professional operation.
Alan Aaron, I want to thank you for being with us. Again, journalist and activist speaking to us from Asia, close to the case of Jafar Sadiq Hamza. 90% chance, it looks like now, that his body has been found. As a report that just came over from the internet of TAPL, the Indonesian human rights group, says, "We bow our heads in tribute to a man who is held so high by people in Aceh and those of us who had the privilege of knowing him and working with him." You're listening to Democracy Now! You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Today in Lima, Peru, the process of interrogation of witnesses has begun in the civilian trial of Lori Berenson, the American woman who is serving a life sentence in Peru on charges of treason against the fatherland. But last week, a military tribunal voided that sentence, saying that Peru will now send her case to a civilian court. Last Thursday, Lori was moved to a maximum security prison in Lima. Today, in a Democracy Now! Exclusive, we release the tape of the only interview ever done with Lori Berenson. It's the first time her voice will be broadcast to the public since she was sentenced to life in prison almost 5 years ago. In March of 1999, I traveled with a U.S. human rights delegation to visit the Socabaya prison in Arequipa, Peru's second city, where Lori was being held. Lori was convicted of helping the Tupac Amaru revolutionary movement. She was tried by a hooded military judge. Prosecutors used secret evidence against her. For 3 years, she was held in the frigid Yanamayo prison in the Andes Mountains in an unheated open-air cell without running water, where her hands swelled like boxing gloves from the cold, and she developed gastric and eye problems. She was later transferred to the Socabaya prison, but there, too, she was held in complete isolation for many months. Amnesty International has called her total isolation cruel and unusual punishment, while a working group of the United Nations High Commissioner of Human Rights determined that, quote, the detention of Lori Berenson is arbitrary and in violation of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Well, on March 2nd, 1999, a year and a half ago, Lori Berenson met us in the prison courtyard. I was with a group headed by the Office of the Americas in Los Angeles. We sat down on six chairs with her in the courtyard, and we are now going to broadcast excerpts of the first taped interview with Lori Berenson. Keep in mind, these excerpts have been approved by both her lawyer and her parents. Lori begins by talking about the civilian trial, which began today in Lima. Again, this tape from a year and a half ago. I felt at this point it would be safer to air it now after she's moved out of the Socabaya prison and into Lima. This is Lori Berenson.
I think it's a way of delaying it. I mean, civilian trials in Peru also can last 6 years. In my case, at this point, with such publicity that I've had, such negative publicity that I've had in Peru, I would never get a fair trial.
Lori Berenson made these comments a year and a half ago when I joined a human rights delegation headed by Blaise Bonpain of the Office of the Americas in Los Angeles and Reverend Lucius Walker of Pastors for Peace in New York. We went to Peru in March of 1999, flew to the Socabaya prison where Berenson had spent 150 days in solitary confinement. Today, for the first time, you'll hear Lori Berenson speak about prison conditions, her hopes for the future, the charges she faced as a leader of the MRTA, the rebel group in Peru that would, a year later, take over the Japanese ambassador's residence. The comments are excerpts of a longer interview screened by Lori Berenson's parents and her lawyer, former U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark. We began by talking about the Yanomayo prison, where Lori has spent the first, 2 to 3 years of her life. The prison is in the Andes with extremely high mountains where wardens are rotated out every 6 months to deal with the altitude, but prisoners can remain there their entire lives.
In Yanomayo, the coldness is a pretty... It's the coldness in itself, it's the fact that there are different certain circumstances that exacerbate the situation in which one feels, like the climate, people, the harassment, in the sense of, they used to send in the special forces of the police and actually hit whack people on the head.
In case you have any trouble understanding what Lori is saying, she said the authorities used to send in the special forces of the police and whack people on the head. She also said the authorities felt she had proved her guilt by raising concerns first about jail conditions and only then about her own case.
I have a difficult time saying, well, I, deal with me,
Yeah.
Forget about the rest of them, they're dying, I can't do that. That would be off the wall if this were out. The conditions were actually pretty worse and pretty bad. So when I complained about that. I didn't complain about, me. And that was I didn't complain about me first. I complained about, in general, and about jail conditions, and I complained. I think it was just about jail conditions and about the civilian trial.
So first you talked about jail conditions,
and then I mentioned the judicial system. I said, there are a lot of people who are here unjustly, and I mentioned myself in that context. Generally, what I always mention is a military court. I mean, she would have been tried by a military court.
Lori Berenson was tried by a hooded military judge, a gun put to her head and those of her defendants as the sentences were read. And they then were sent off to the Yanomayo prison high in the Andes, where the conditions were extremely grave. But she said the situation after a few years changed well for her when the Organization of American States took up her case. It's then that they moved her.
I was moved the day before my case was to be seen in the OAS Human Rights Commission, Inter-American Human Rights Commission. And that was more than my health, because, although my health has failed in jail, it's certainly not nearly as grave as there are several people who are really in serious shape. I couldn't even say life or death. I was moved with 3 people who were in wheelchairs. Because of cerebral damage from mostly, at least 2 of them, I believe, is from torture. And I remember two of the women I lived with were in really serious health conditions. One for bleeding ulcers, the other one for cerebral damage from torture. So
at Yanomayo?
Yes.
And where were they moved to?
No, they weren't moved. I was the only one moved. That's why I'm sure it's not for health reasons.
In case you missed any of that, the recording conditions are not what you'd call ideal at the Socabaya prison. But Lori Berenson said that while she was moved to the Socabaya prison, women in much worse shape than she, though her health was failing too, women who had been tortured and suffering cerebral damage were not moved because their cases were not being considered by the Organization of American States. But let's go back a little further to those days in December of 1995, right after Lori was arrested, how she ended up at the Yanomayo prison and then at Socabaya and now at the Chirrios prison in Lima as the state considers another trial for Lori Berenson. After she was arrested, taken off a bus by the Dincote, that's the military anti-terrorist police, she was brought to their offices. And she was held. While she was held for a period of time, not speaking with anyone, a woman was brought into her cell. She describes her condition.
And she was in pretty... She had five bullet wounds. Two arms, two legs, and and one that entered her bladder and intestine. So she was in pretty lousy shape. They had left her on a dirty mattress, naked. Yeah, I mean, probably with a shirt on or something. Filthy mattress with five open wounds, which is pretty horrendous. I mean, there were a lot of rats in like that.
How many days was she in the cell?
I was in the same cell with her for probably 11, 12 days before.
It was after this period that Lori Berenson was taken by the military police, the Dinkote, and presented before the press. This minute would be the last recording of Lori Berenson as she headed back to jail. She says they told her she had a minute to speak and that there were no microphones. And so she sounded angry, she was speaking fast, and she was agitated.
It's a reaction to the holding conditions in general, and a reaction
to
the system. To the whole,
what you saw.
To what was going to come. So when I talk about institutionalized violence, in the sense of hunger and misery, it's all sense of how they kill people in Dinkote, and I was aware of that at that time.
How long were you held without being allowed to talk to anyone from the moment you were captured?
I mean, we were in singular cells. We were not until the 27th, when I was put in with another person.
December 27th.
Yeah, December 27th. With my Peruvian lawyer, I was not allowed to see him before I testified. Before I gave my statement.
Soon after, Lori was presented to the press. She and several others were brought before a hooded military judge who pronounced her guilty of treason. He said she was a leader of the MRTA and was sentenced to life in prison for treason against the fatherland.
Did they present any evidence at the trial?
No. In the actual trial, no. Absolutely nothing.
Are you innocent of the charges?
Yes, of the charges. Yes, I'm innocent of all the charges they've made against me.
Which brings us to the U.S. and what the U.S. is doing here around your case, the U.S. government. What is the U.S. doing? Are they helping?
There has been some pressure at certain times, but not heavy pressure. Not heavy enough pressure, at least, because I'm still here. Mm-hmm.
Do you think if they put pressure, you wouldn't be here?
I think in the sense of more than the Congress in itself, I mean, all the military aid they give and that kind of support and the patting on the back of Fujimori every time he does anything. I think he feels like he's fine.
Again, this was Lori speaking a year and a half ago. At this point, more than half the U.S. Congress and 43 senators have signed a letter calling for Lori Berenson's release. At the same time, the Peruvian President Fujimori is under enormous pressure, having since 1999 taken power a third time, this in a kind of election coup that even the U.S. was forced to admit was deeply flawed. But Lori has always been more interested in grassroots movements than electoral politics. She talked about the general living conditions of Peruvians.
But I do know that in the last years, the living conditions of the general Peruvians are much worse since the neoliberal plan has been implemented. It still seems to be a society that is quite unjust, in which the entire, not only the left, like the center opposition, everyone is so scared they won't say anything. So scared the press won't say anything. And so it just leaves you in a position in which there's very little democracy. I mean, a real right to live, a right to health, happiness. I think it's actually worse. And you need democratic opening in society so that people have a right to say, hey, I'm not in agreement with this.
Lori, is there any last comment you would like to make here and through this as a comment to people?
I think we should be aware of the situation. Being lived here by my person and other people, and hopefully change conditions in general in the jails and in Peru. I hope that I will be freed and live, get out of here at some point.
If you got out, what would you do?
I'm sorry? In what sense?
If you were let out.
I have dedicated my adult years to social justice issues, and I do not plan to stop doing that. I think I'd be much more useful in this world for myself as a person, for other people in this world. Not in the sense that like, I'm a useful person, but in the sense that I could be much, I could do much more with my life, and maybe for other people's lives if I was not here.
Laurie Berenson, American prisoner in Peru. Her body may be in jail, but her words have escaped. President Fujimori of Peru is in New York this week for the largest gathering of world leaders ever. He will be at the St. Regis Hotel on Friday. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! When we come back, we will hear from the Reverend Jesse Jackson, who says he wants to go to Peru and bring Laurie Berenson home. Again, those the first words that Laurie Berenson has spoken publicly since she was sentenced to life in prison by a military tribunal. You're listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. Today, a Democracy Now! Exclusive, the words, the voice of Laurie Berenson. And now we turn to the Reverend Jesse Jackson, who stood outside the Peruvian mission in New York yesterday with New York Congressmember Carolyn Maloney and held a news conference calling for Laurie Berenson's release. The Reverend Jackson.
Let me express my thanks on behalf of the Rainbow Push Coalition, on behalf of Congresswoman Maloney and Mr. Berenson, and to his wife who is in Peru today. We met with the family last week in Chicago, and we've made preparations to go to Peru to meet with Mr. Fujimori, to meet with Laurie in jail there, to make a moral appeal to him on humanitarian grounds to release her. She's been in jail for nearly 5 years now. She is no threat to Peru. To release her is to bring a wall down, to build a bridge, to make better relations between the nations. While we are prepared to go to Peru, he will be in New York the next 2 days. We hope to meet with him while he is in the city at this time. Each time we've made these moral appeals, humanitarian appeals to regain the release of someone held captive, there's always been some argument, some reason to keep them there. But there must be an even greater argument, an even superior reason to set the captive free. We went to get Lieutenant Robert Goodman from Syria, and the case made by Mr. Saad was they were two American pilots in uniform threatening his country. And while there may have been some measure of threat, there was an even greater possibility of opening dialogue between the U.S. and Syria. And one byproduct releasing Lieutenant Robert Goodman was Mr. Reagan and Mr. Assad then began a communications. Mr. Castro made the argument that he had been in isolation 30 years and he should keep Americans held captive there. We said someone had to take the risk to build the bridge, and 40 Americans and Cuban Americans were released from jail there. We made the same case with Saddam Hussein in Iraq when he was going to use women as human shields before the Gulf War started. Again, we made the appeal to him to take the risk for peace, to build a bridge, to send the gesture that there are no downsides in peace gestures. Last year, when bombs were falling in Yugoslavia, we met with Mr. Milosevic and said to him, though bombs are falling and three American soldiers are here, don't use them as trophies. Don't let them be impediments to peace. Release them and build a bridge. In that same tradition, we approached Mr. Fujimori to release Lori, to let her go. She's been in jail 5 years. If there is any break, it is that the military court has determined that perhaps it was an error in their judgment. She never had a jury of her peers. She never could submit her own evidence. And they've determined 5 years later that, in fact, it must go from military to civilian court. That is a quantitative material break in this case. I hope that Mr. Fujimori will meet with us while he's in the city this week, will allow us to come visit him in Peru and, in fact, visit her and be a factor in gaining her release. Thank you very much.
Justin, do you have any indication that he will meet with you? Do you have any kind of a communication that...
We do not. We called his office several times last week. They said he would be in New York this week. I'll be a part of UN activities during the course of the week. I expect to see him, hopefully formally and directly, if not informally and indirectly, but to make the appeal to him. If he comes here to seek to do what? United Nations, to bring down walls and to build bridges, and to overcome yesterday's scars, to go forward by our dreams and not backwards by our fears. We've seen the labeling of terrorism across the years. We've seen people overcome those labels. It was not long ago that the ANC, the African National Congress, could not go 30 miles outside of New York and were called terrorists. It was not long ago that the PLO could not travel 30 miles outside of New York and the Young was fired for talking with the PLO representative. But in time, we've overcome these scars. We've built bridges. And I say between the U.S. and Peru, let's build another bridge. Let's give peace a chance. Let's release Laura that she might come home and be set free.
More than half the Congress has called for Lori Berenson to be freed, but President Clinton has not made a public statement calling for her to be freed.
Well, I will appeal to him to do so. We send everything to gain and nothing to lose by seeking her freedom. It's the morally right thing to do. It's also a chance to build bridges between nations. I hope Mr. Fujimori can hear the rational and the moral appeal of our reasoning and let her go. Today, her hopes are rising because the military court has determined that she was falsely imprisoned in the first place. Her mother's there with her. We expect to go there and be with her, but not just to be with her, but to seek her release and bring her home.
Peru that it is in their best interests to release her. Why would this be in their best interests?
Because as they seek stronger diplomatic relations and trade relations and be a member of the family of nations, a lack of human rights, political prisoners are impediments. And so in their own quest to be a part of the family of nations and their own quest for diplomatic ties and trade ties, releasing her as an asset and keeping her as an impediment.
Do you think that's what they want to do, that they're looking to?
Well, I would like to think that there are reasons, both material and moral. And my case is not that of a lawyer or that of a general. It is that of making a moral appeal. Peru is not safer because she's in jail. Relations are not better because she's in jail. But they could get better if she is freed from jail. It would have, at this point, a worldwide impact.
You were with Vice President Gore yesterday. Did you raise the issue of Lori Berenson with him?
Did not raise that issue on yesterday with him. It was not the appropriate time. Not does he have the power at this point to make the appeal. In some sense, President Clinton has the authority to do that. But more than that, Mr. Fujimori himself has the power to use extraordinary powers to release her. This time, 2 weeks ago, there were four journalists in jail in Liberia. And we appealed directly to President Taylor. And they went through a process for a week, but then we kept making the appeal, joined by Nelson Mandela. And after a week of appeals, Mr. Taylor
let four journalists go free last Saturday. We hope that Mr. Fujimori will, in that same spirit, let Lori go.
Twice, members of Congress have joined me in traveling to Peru to free Lori Berenson, and many of us will be going again to Peru on her behalf.
New York Congressmember Carolyn Maloney.
And whatever the outcome, appealing on humanitarian grounds that she be allowed to come home. On Friday, there is a meeting that I've been invited to with President Fujimori, and we are hopeful that Reverend Jackson can come if he's in town, but he will probably see him before then. But there is a meeting on Friday with President Fujimori here.
With Lori Berenson on the agenda, or?
Lori Berenson is always on my agenda.
What's the purpose of the meeting with Fujimori?
He's having a luncheon here at one of the hotels. He's a part of the UN.
Yeah, I understand that. Are you invited to the luncheon and some other Aegis, or what's the reason?
I'm invited to the luncheon, and I've also appealed for a private meeting. He knows that I'm interested in Lori Berenson, so if I'm invited, I'm sure that's the agenda, or a certain a part of it.
The
luncheon.
Mm-hmm. I think it's also important to know that when we shed light on the predicament of political prisoners, it always helps, because the nation stands to lose by imprisoning her and stands to gain by releasing her. This is not good news for Peru. It's not good news for the Berenson family. It's not good for diplomatic ties. It's not good news for trade. There are no upsides in keeping her, and there are all upsides in releasing her. And even if there were a rub, 5 years in jail is long enough. I think ultimately our case rests on the moral appeal. The fact is, the military court found after 5 years that they did not have a case to be made. And this kicked it from military to civilian. The case is prejudiced against her there. The likelihood that she can have a fair trial by traditional means is not great. And therefore, the moral appeal is the correct appeal. The appeal between our two countries. We will urge world opinion to be a factor in gaining her release. And I'm hopeful because while we have been down, we know that the ground is no place for champions, and we are champions in our quest for peace, our quest for human rights. She will be set free because our hope will outlast the cynicism and the fear.
He has a good record. He's brought a lot of people home.
The original charge against her was treason, which is kind of weird for somebody who's not a citizen of the country in which they're charged. Do you have any indication of whether that would be repeated as a charge, or is there some other charge that this civilian court would bring?
The main point, I think you raised a very, very important point that she was, how in the world can you convict someone of treason when you're not even a member of that country? And so I think that there are a lot of arguments in her support. She, for the first time, will be able to submit evidence. She'll be able to question evidence. But the main point is the point that Reverend Jackson has made so eloquently, and that is a humanitarian appeal, a just appeal. She has served 5 years. Now we hear under evidence that was faulty, and it is time for her to come home. Better than I am. You take this. Tell him, humanitarian, right?
But when the four journalists were arrested in Liberia, the two from Britain, one from South Africa, one from Sierra Leone, they were charged with treason and espionage. And what happens when governments react to repress, they drop their strongest charges to make their case. It's almost a kind of overkill. She was not a spy, did not engage in treason against a government that was not her own. She was labeled a terrorist because she showed sympathy to those fighting for the poor and the defenseless, which is the morally right thing to do. But at some point in time, we must remove the scars of yesterday's fears. After all, Peru's best days are in front of it. And Mr. Fujimori has an opportunity to seize this moment, to let her go free. But more than that, to in fact reassess the whole human rights question. I mean, the people of Peru need strong ties with our country. They need strong diplomatic ties. They need strong trade ties. They need investment. And political prisoners in under these conditions are impediments to growth. And of course, when growth does not occur, the people hurt. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. Do you know how he's...
The Reverend Jesse Jackson and New York Congressmember Carolyn Maloney in Manhattan yesterday calling for the release of Lori Berenson, whose civilian trial, it looks like, has just gotten underway, beginning with the interrogation of various witnesses. Mark Berenson again joins us. Lori's father, her mother, Rhoda Berenson, is in Lima right now as she tries to slow down the process that is taking place, along with their attorney, former U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark. Mark Berenson, what is happening right now?
As far as we know, the judge will be going to visit Lori this morning in the prison to try to get testimony from her, and she's going to simply tell the judge what she said last Thursday. I am not represented. I don't have adequate time to prepare. We have not found a lawyer. I don't know that I even want to have a lawyer and legitimize a farce, an illegitimate system. I need time to prepare a case. It is wrong for you to go ahead. And we understand from the Peruvian papers, which are as correct as a broken wristwatch, they're right one time in every 12. In this morning's papers, they're saying there was a testimony given by other people against Lori yesterday without Lori having representation present. Why are they steamrolling this? This is democracy. This is due process. I don't know all the facts. I'm not able to speak regularly with my wife. She and Ramsey are working the system, trying to learn the parameters, learn the limitations, and see whether we want to participate or whether Lori should do this thing herself and just act on her own behalf, and rather than try to legitimize a farce.
Has anyone explained the rules of a civilian trial to you?
As far as I know, the Roeder and Ramsey Clark have not yet, as of last night, been totally apprised of what the process is, how long it takes, what the parameters are. They're still waiting to find out that information. And with this, Peru allegedly is steamrolling and starting the case without Lori's representation. This is due process. This is democracy. This is justice.
Well, in the same way there might be some steamrolling going on in Peru, there is certainly a growing movement here. Last week, you were on the Oprah show and then went over to a news conference with Jesse Jackson in Chicago with Stevie Wonder.
Yes, that was wonderful to meet Stevie Wonder, a great humanitarian and world-famous musical genius. And he was on the stage and asked, what are you doing here? He said, well, I'm here with Mr. Jackson. He's explained this case to me. I've been following it for a very long time. Lori has been wrong. This is unjust, and said something to the effect that she must be released.
Yesterday when you were on, and today with a lot of attention to these newly released tapes of Lori Berenson speaking, not in that set-up situation of coming out of being in a closed cell with a woman who had been shot five times, but speaking to us at the Socabaya prison a year and a half ago. You told us yesterday about the four names that were on the appeal that Lori made, instructed to do so really by the Peruvian government, which ultimately led to the voiding of her military sentence in the last week. Can you tell us who are the four top government people who said that they have known that Lori Berenson is not a leader of the MRTA?
Yes, to put this in context, it's over a year that the Peruvian government came to us and to the United States to tell them that they had information that Lori was not this horrible monster that they created then, but unfortunately demagogued and continued to create during the runoff of President Fujimori's victory recently. And when we went to investigate this, they provided us with four names so that we could have that in the petition that Lori filed. The four names are Admiral Luigi Giampietri, who retired, the highest-ranking admiral in the Peruvian Navy, current ambassador to the United Nations, Jorge Valdez Carrillo, Peruvian ambassador, permanent representative to the United Nations. The third person that testified or gave affidavits on this was the former Bolivian ambassador to Peru, the Honorable Jorge Gamuccio. The fourth person who was named in this but did not, and perhaps because of political reasons after, did not provide testimony, though was named in the petition, is the current vice president of Peru, former foreign minister, and former permanent representative ambassador to the United Nations, Francisco Tudela, who's in New York today.
And these are the four people who have said to the Peruvian government that they know and have evidence that Lori is not a leader of the MRTA. I want to thank you, Mark Berenson, for being with us. And what do you think as you hear your daughter's voice, though you do get to visit her?
Well, I think that now the world doesn't see the screaming person who is outraged by the treatment of Lucinda, the woman who she said had five bullet holes and a spilling colostomy bag and rats running around Lori's bed adjacent to hers in a 6.5 by 6.5 filthy small holding cell that caused the outrage. I think you can hear a human voice where Lori says, I'm innocent of these charges, where she says prison conditions in Peru are awful, that many people have been tortured, that the journalists are afraid to speak out, that society has had that problem. Now, there has been some change due to the candidacy of Alejandro Toledo, but in the end, we still have a repressive system there, and Lori, if you knew about that, would probably continue to say that. At least you hear a human being who cares about social justice and cares about humanity and those less fortunate than herself.
Well, let's go out of this segment by again hearing the closing words of Lori Berenson. Again, the excerpts that we played were approved by Lori's lawyer, former U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark, and her family, her parents, Rhoda and Mark Berenson. Mark, who joins us today, Lori Berenson.
Last comment you would like to make here and through this as a comment to people?
I think you should be aware of the situation. Being lived here by my person and other people, and hopefully change conditions in general in the jails and in Peru. I hope that I were to be freed and get out of here at some point.
If you got out, what would you do?
I'm sorry? In what sense?
If you were let out.
I have dedicated my adult years to social justice issues, and I do not plan to stop doing that. I think I'd be much more useful in this world for myself as a person, for other people in this world. Not in the sense that like I'm a useful person, but in the sense that I could do much more with my life and maybe for other people's lives if I was not here.
Lori Berenson speaking from prison in Peru. If any network, if any radio station, if any micro radio station, any community group wants to broadcast these words, you can get in touch with us at Democracy Now! Here in New York at community radio station WBAI of Pacifica Radio, and we're making those cassettes available. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! When we come back, we'll be joined by Vandana Shiva and John Kavanagh to talk about globalization and the massive gathering of world leaders that is taking place in New York and where exactly they fit in. Stay with us. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Well, while the UN has kicked off its Millennium Summit with kings, prime ministers, and presidents, convened in the largest world meeting in history. A very different global summit has convened across town. Grassroots activists from all over the world have been gathering. They'll be protesting this week and meeting to map out their view of the world. The event that took place yesterday at New York's Town Hall was called Globalization and the Role of the United Nations. Can the United Nations be salvaged? One of the programs that the International Forum on Globalization has held in the past year to launch a new set of ideas for alternative economic models and institutions that give primacy to values favoring human welfare and the natural world over global corporate interests. Vandana Shiva joins us now. Dr. Shiva is a well-known physicist, philosopher, and ecofeminist. She is on the board of the IFG, the International Forum on Globalization, director of the Research Foundation for Science, Technology, and Ecology in India, vice president of the Third World Network, and author of a number of books, including Stolen Harvest. Welcome to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us. You addressed two major gatherings, one being the International Forum on Globalization. The other
was the State of the World Forum, which was a brainchild of Gorbachev, who yesterday at the opening, which I shared with him and Soros, and you had George Soros, Gorbachev, all admitting that globalization was basically about enlargement of the space for corporations, the invasion into political decisions that should really be under the control of people. It was an erosion of democracy and a threat to the survival of people and the planet.
What do you think about the United Nations and its role in this new millennium?
Well, you know, we've seen in the 90s a decade of the UN correcting the gap between the statement of we the peoples and an institution that was really state-led. We had the Rio Summit, we've had the Women's Summits, we've had the Social Summit opening up the UN system to people. And yet the Millennium Summit is, instead of being a celebration of how to open up the UN and how to subject the Bretton Woods institutions to UN rules of a people-led international system, what we're seeing is the UN Summit at this point has closed the doors to all the NGOs to whom it opened the doors during the 90s. And instead the UN system is really being used as a massive commercial prostitute house where the CEOs of India and the US will be making deals of information technology and biotechnology. Our public tax money is going to be used to basically create business opportunities. And meantime, the UN as an international system for the defense of the rights of people is now becoming part of the addendum to the World Bank, the World Trade Organization, and IMF to serve corporate interests. We are in New York to prevent that from happening because the United Nations belongs to the people.
John Kavanagh joins us as well as Dr. Vandana Shiva. He is co-director of the Institute for Policy Studies. John, if you were speaking right now, as opposed to President Clinton, who is opening the massive millennium gathering, what would you be saying to the world leaders?
Well, that would be a nice invitation. What I would say, and I think what the International Forum on Globalization focused on yesterday, is that as the people's movements that have gathered momentum since Seattle, as we make the case to the world that the big Bretton Woods institutions, the World Bank and the IMF and the World Trade Organization are undermining people's basic rights, have become platforms for corporate rights, we need some countervailing power. Now, many of us, we're at a fascinating stage in this movement where we know what we're against. We actually have momentum in downsizing, I think, those institutions. We will win on many fronts, I think, against those big institutions. We're at a stage where we need to define what we're for. And part of what I would say if I were standing in front of the United Nations is the United Nations can be a piece of a better world, but we've got to protect it, as Vandana said, from corporate takeover. Very disturbing thing happened 3 weeks ago. I would speak out against this, which is that Kofi Annan invited the heads of 44 major corporations into the UN to sign a global compact, which asks corporations to respect human rights, but has no enforcement powers. That in essence allows corporations to wrap themselves, Nike, Shell, in the UN flag. this is not the right route for the United Nations. We need a strong, independent United Nations that can help create some checks and balances on corporations.
People can go to the Democracy Now! Website and check out the debate that we had on the Global Compact, which included the vice president of Nike, as well as a spokesperson for the United Nations, and CorpWatch as well, talking about this new possibility, these vistas that have opened that mean the UN olive branch might be on a flag with or on a logo with Nike.
Yeah. You know, part of the problem with the United Nations, and I fault our citizens' movement some in this, we have not paid enough attention to the United Nations except for the wonderful summits which Vandana mentioned. The United Nations is there to be molded and shaped. If people's movements see it as a vital part of the future, its documents, its human rights declaration, they form some of the roadmaps of our people's movements. We can keep the United Nations from being taken over. We had a very successful attempt, CorpWatch and other members of the IFG, in knocking out an attempted corporate takeover of one UN body, the UN Development Program. We're going to focus a lot of attention over the next year in trying to make the United Nations corporate-free and shift the momentum back to the United Nations being a place that can provide. We've got a world where corporations are run amok. Much of the resistance and countervailing power will come at local and national levels, but we also need some checks at the global level. And the UN, we've got to fix it because it's all that we have.
Dr. Vandana Shiva, will you be in Prague for the protests that will be taking place there around the World Bank and the IMF?
It's ended up being part of the defense of one's national sovereignty, national democracy, local economies, biodiversity, cultural diversity, that we just have to be present and not allow Seattle to become a platform for the voice of the World Trade Organization and not allow Prague to be reduced to new recipes of the World Bank and IMF of how to impoverish the poor further. Yes, the diverse women of diversity, this global movement of which I am a part for the defense of biological and cultural diversity, is organizing with the East European women, ecofeminists, a major mobilization. And the theme of the mobilization is life is not for sale. It was chosen by the East European women.
Hmm. What about India today and the issues of biotechnology that you have taken on? Do you think you've made a dent, for example, in the struggle around Monsanto that you have taken on so voraciously?
I think we've made a dent, and it is part of the success of that impact that corporations like Monsanto and the biotech industry is finding new strategies of how to continue to push unwanted seeds, untested technologies, costly technologies on third world people in the name of feeding the hungry. One new strategy is to use government institutions more and more, and while we see the hijack of our states, we also see the hijack of the UN system. While European consumers and increasingly American consumers are questioning why on earth should we be force-fed to eat GM foods, the rejected material is being sent to the third world. Again, public tax money in the World Food Program and USAID is being used to buy up the rejected foodstuff and dump it on us. The entire children's feeding program in India, the World Food Program financed and USAID financed program, of corn and soya blend, a horrible diet within the Indian context where we have some of the best foods that the palate could ever taste, is being dumped. And in addition to that, the FAO is being increasingly used to blindly support biotech as the only way to solve the hunger problem when we know the Green Revolution increased the hunger problem, displaced small peasants from the land, and the second Green Revolution as a package of patented technologies, as a package of genetic engineering molded by chemical industry to sell more Roundup, to sell more herbicides, to sell more pesticides, to sell costly seeds. It's going to create even more poverty. More farmers will commit suicide. More farmers are going to sell their kidneys. We're having a public hearing on the status of the seed and the biotech industry on the 24th and 25th in Bangalore, when the seed industry will be meeting to plan their new marketing in China, India, Malaysia, Philippines. On the issue that biotech is necessary for feeding the hungry,
I just did a calculation. Everyone is being taken for this huge hype on the golden rice, that vitamin A rice, genetically engineered, is going to be the solution to the vitamin A deficiencies of 2 million babies. We worked out the calc on the basis of what they aim at. They don't have vitamin A rice. It'll take 10 years to develop it. When they do get it, it'll have 33.3 micrograms of vitamin A equivalent in 100 grams of rice. You eat 30 grams on a basic meal. You'd have to eat 3 kilograms in a meal to get adequate vitamin A. No one ever could. And if you don't eat the 3 kilograms and eat the normal amount of rice, you'll only meet 1% of your required vitamin A, all of which could be met if we were helping women get the right seeds for their vegetable gardens and their home gardens, even in the slum, this amazing tree called the drumstick tree, richest source of vitamin A. People's knowledge, women's knowledge, biodiversity are all being eclipsed to push the monoculture of monopoly culture of the global corporations. To us, biotech is the area where this fight is taking place, and we will have to deal with the United Nations system and our states to reclaim them back, to be instruments of serving the people and defending the rights.
The biotech companies have certainly fought back in this country. I think the tens of millions of dollars they've put into advertising and focusing on medical science, how biotechnology helps people. John Cavanna, you know about this strategy?
Sure. Oh, sure. Biotech, they've had the advertising blitz of the century in promising people that both in pharmaceuticals and agriculture, they are the future. I think Vandana's stories, though, are magnified around the world. More and more small farmers are saying, this is not working for us. More and more farmers are trying to reclaim the right to control their seeds, control their collective property. It's a fight over, in a sense, the future of the world, the individual property system of these private corporations versus a collective property system of farmers. I think it's indicative of many of the battles we face in the corporate globalization world. We're shifting now from a defensive struggle fighting against the big institutions to an offensive struggle. In India, Vandana and others are building a living democracy movement to try and reclaim the collective community control over natural resources. This is the next few years of this movement. It will be very creative, very diverse. The International Forum on Globalization is sponsoring a 2-year process to foster alternatives that work from the bottom up.
The website?
The website of my institution, IPS, is www.ips-dc.org, and IFG is www.ifg.org.
Last contact information, Dr. Vandana Shiva.
The email is vshiva@vsnl.com.
vshiva@vsnl.com, and you can go to our website and get all this information at www.democracynow.org, and you can email us at mail@democracynow.org. We'd like to hear from you. The website, finding out more information on Lori Berenson, is www.freelori.org. And again, any media outlet that would like to call or grassroots group to get the cassette of the excerpts of Lori's voice talking about prisons in Peru, the human rights situation there, you can contact us at WBAI in New York. Democracy Now! Is produced by Jillian Aldrich and Sidrock Franklin. Our engineer is Matthew Finch. Happy birthday to Robert Knight. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.